From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The coronavirus pandemic is far from over, in spite of lockdowns and quarantines easing in many cities and nations around the world. It is arguable if the world will ever go back to normal, or if we have to invent a new normal in order to survive the virus. In one of the global epicenters of the disease, Italy, a physicist and novelist published the first book about COVID-19, exploring the crisis through the lens of science and society. His book, which was first published in essay form, was shared millions of times online and is thought to have changed the debate around the coronavirus. We go now to Rome to speak with Paolo Giordano, who's the author of the critically acclaimed Like Family and the Human Body, as well as the international bestseller The Solitude of Prime Numbers, which has been translated into more than 40 languages. He has a PhD in particle physics. His latest book is called How Contagion Works: Science, Awareness, and Community in Times of Global Crisis, the essay that helped change the COVID-19 debate. Welcome to the program, Paolo.
Thank you, Sonali. Hi, everybody.
So Italy was a preview to the United States of what was in store for us. I recall those weeks when Italian hospitals were overrun, and it was a desperate time as the world looked at what was happening in Italy. And most of us who took this virus seriously knew that that is likely what was going to face us here in the United States. How did you, tell me about the process of writing this essay. You wrote this and started writing it, I believe, in late February, which on the global scale was still sort of early on in the crisis?
Yes, the first official Italian case was found on February 21st in the north of the country. And I published the first article 3 or 4 days after that in the newspaper. And I started the book on February 29. So Italy was still in that phase of confusion and disbelief that each country went through after China, after Italy. So people were still divided into two parts. Some were talking about a serious situation, but most of the people actually were still talking about a regular seasonal flu and saying that there was nothing to worry about. We still had politicians making video selfies where they said, come to Italy, there is no problem, there is nothing going on. So I basically wrote the book very fast against this confusion that was all around me.
And I'm, of course, assuming that it helps greatly that you were already a well-established writer, but also a scientist, somebody with a scientific background. So those two skills together help to translate this this issue, which still remains so confusing for so many people, because this is still a relatively new virus whose science is still being discovered and researched upon. But you started by simply trying to explain what constitutes an epidemic. Can you go through that logic with us? Why a virus becomes an epidemic when it is so contagious?
It's more difficult for me to explain this in English, so I probably won't be as clear. But the problem is basically our relationships, and the problem is proximity with other people. That's the very big paradox in which the whole population of the world suddenly found itself. No, the idea that in order to take care of other people, we needed to stay away from other people, to step back from those who we love in order to protect them. And I basically relied on mathematics to try and explain this in the beginning. Also because at that time, the health emergency hadn't started yet. we were still in between. So the numbers of the contagion were rising and rising daily, but those contagions hadn't yet turned into serious cases and then into deaths. So it was still a time when the epidemics was only visible through math and through the idea that there was something invisible spreading among the population. So that's more or less exactly how the mathematical model behind the description of an epidemic works. It's basically the idea of little balls hitting one another, and the more get hit by the same one, and the faster this happens, the worst the spread of the epidemic is. And there are parameters that describe how serious this becomes. So I just tried to describe this because I thought it could make people, on the one side, less scared, because I think that people become less scared when they have a clear explanation of what is going on. And on the other hand, on the opposite side, maybe people could have the right expectations about what would happen in the next weeks, because many people were still saying, okay, this will be over in a couple of weeks, which was completely nonsense if you just looked at the spread.
In fact, there was at least one. There have been so many studies on this issue. One study recently showed that had there not been the lockdowns that were put in place, there would have been 60 million more infections that would have resulted from just going about business as usual. It's very, very, there's a lot of strong evidence to show that the lockdowns, when they were put in place, did serve to curb the rapid spread of the disease. But what you're saying, I think, is so important. This idea of clear. Go ahead.
Can I interrupt you for a moment? Because I think this is interesting for the American audience, since Italy in this sense is still advanced by a few weeks with respect to the United States. And what is happening here these days is that we're sort of having a wave of denial that is rising up again, and many people are starting to say, oh, so the models that you relied upon were all wrong because the situation that you imagined didn't turn out to be true. So we don't have that many people in intensive care and so on and so forth. So I guess this will also happen elsewhere afterwards, but we have to remember that we're not in those worst case scenarios exactly because we were able to build those scenarios and to avoid them with the lockdowns and all the other measures. But then things get mixed up very easily. Sorry
Well,
if I
no,
hit you on
that's a
this.
really important point, and that is definitely something that we see. I suppose it's sort of human nature for some people to feel that you end up becoming the victim of success, that the policies put in place to avoid a crisis, when they are successfully avoided, people turn around and say, well, look, there was no crisis, so why did we go through that hardship? But this is the point that I wanted to make next was that so the transmission of information, clear information, is so critical in times of crises like this. Right now, I'm wondering if you can expand on how your essay helped to change this debate, because we saw even the World Health Organization and here in the United States, our Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in the beginning of the pandemic, put out sometimes contradictory, slightly confusing information. And that did a lot of damage because people didn't feel that they could trust information from the authorities that are supposed to be telling them what is exactly going on, what's at stake, and what they need to do, right?
Yeah, and it's still causing a lot of damage, if I have to say. I mean, World Health Organization said that people who don't have symptom probably are not that cannot really transmit the virus. And then a few hours later, they sort of withdrew that information. And this has been going on again and again. And we relied on experts, but we've also seen experts arguing with each other and saying all the possible things. Well, there are many factors that come into this. And of course, they can be confusing for a wide audience, but they really are in the very essence of science also. And the first thing is that science is made by humans, so you get to see all the human flaws that you see in all other disciplines, and you need to take that into account and to accept them. But there's also something that is more deeply related with science. Sometimes we expect we project on science the idea that science is about knowing things. It's about knowledge. But every scientist, I think, knows that science is much more about not knowing things. It's about doubt, it's about confrontation, it's about testing theories and seeing where the theory collapses and trying to expand it. So for once, this was happening in front of people during an emergency, and all the scientists were in a very uncomfortable position because we are still doing research while the emergency is happening, which is not the best way, not the most comfortable way to do that. So we heard people saying we don't know, and I understand this can be confusing for people, but it's just the essence of what science is, I think.
I want to explore the other part of your essay where you come to the realization how this particular virus is unfortunately so well suited to spreading in a society that humanity has created that is so interconnected, the very thing that has made us such a unique and had us find ourselves in such a unique moment in history, you know, with pre-pandemic, find ourselves on the other side of the planet over the span of, you know, 12 hours in an airplane. That very thing is what has made us so vulnerable. And you point out that we as human beings really need to, through this pandemic, see the impact that we've had on our planet. Do you think that we can have a cultural shift in thinking, in reflecting on what this virus has shown us?
It would be disgraceful if this wasn't the case, but we don't have to take it for granted. I mean, when I wrote this very short essay, I did it also because I kind of saw in this dramatic experience also the possibility for people and leaders to be more, to listen a little more attentively for a moment. So I just saw that possibility of pointing out complex chains of thoughts that all come from science, but that have such a hard time in finding their space in the usual debate. But honestly, I have to say now, after 3 months, that space seems to me that window has already been closed. So I don't know. The opposite could actually happen. I mean, we were with a lot of effort, we were starting to build a conscience, a common conscience about the planet in the last years, also thanks to the younger generations. And what could happen is that this crisis stops those movements, stops the political things that were being done or starting to be done. So it really depends on what we do now, because this is the time in which money is invested, in which politics are decided for the future to come. And that's why I'm trying so hard to discuss any of these subjects with whomever I can.
Are you worried that the nationalism that has been on display in so many countries just gets exacerbated as well with this pandemic that, you know, we have, and the United States, unfortunately, is perhaps one of the most guilty nations in the world in looking at this pandemic through, you know, selfish eyes, wanting to acquire a vaccine just for Americans, not, you know, cooperating with the global community that's trying to tackle this. But then there's also the issue of the fact that in the so-called first world, we have access to healthcare that is far superior and yet strained by the pandemic. And there's still so many parts of Africa or Latin America or Asia where the virus is hitting now, where we could see a crisis of untold proportions. And then we wonder, well, who would be responsible for that? So this, the sort of nationalism versus globalization, for lack of a better term, although that's a fraught term, where do you think that's going to go?
Again, it's very hard to tell. It's quite a shame, no, that we, at least in Europe, but I think that United States is starting to feel more or less the same. We kind of feel that we're going out of the crisis, so we feel sort of relieved by the situation, and the pandemic is hitting so hard, as you said, countries in South America, for instance. But still, we feel those places so far away from our sensibility. That's a shame on one side, but that's also a problem, because what the pandemic has revealed us is exactly the opposite. I mean, the whole world in less than 2 months has been completely affected by a virus that started somewhere, somehow, in a province of China that most of us never heard about. So this is a proof of the level of globalization and of how much health security cannot be a national issue or a national problem. It has to be a global problem, because if health security is not assured in every place of the world, then it is very likely to hit us very fast. That's what we saw. It's not just about solidarity in the end. We can even make it a selfish thought if that's what we need. But it seems to me that we're very far away from that, because, I mean, countries in Europe were acting as if the virus could not hit them when the virus was already hitting Italy. And the United States did the same. And we're seeing countries like Brazil, where the situation is the one that it is. You talk about nationalism. That's for sure a threat. It could even come out stronger from an experience like this. And it would be only the last paradox of this situation, because nationalist countries prove to be completely inappropriate in dealing with the crisis. And
finally, there's the, and this sort of goes hand in hand with nationalism in our modern day, and that is the spread of misinformation, fake news, propaganda, conspiracy theories, etc. We were talking about science early and the importance of clear communication, but we've also seen the wildest sorts of conspiracy theories that have actually been echoed by some leaders, and spread around and really hurt public health. You know, when people believe things like wearing a mask can actually make the virus worse, or that the virus just doesn't exist, or that it's all a hoax, or it's worsened by the 5G network, etc. How critically important is it for us to understand that the spread of misinformation, particularly through our digital world today, is a huge part of the problem facing humanity?
You know, that's exactly the problem with this all, that we're mentioning so many big things in this short talk. We're talking about the planet, we're talking about information, we're talking about the pandemic and nationalism. And it might seem that we're just jumping from one thing to another, but that's not the case. The problem is really resides in the connections that exist between all these things. And these connections build a very complex system. And my idea is that the whole problem resides in the effort that we're not making to figure out this complexity. We need people to make these connections, these complex connections, but we have a politics that is completely shifting in the opposite direction, because it just gives oversimplified answers about everything. It expresses itself via tweets and posts where no complex ideas can really be explained and conveyed. So, information is definitely the key problem, I think, in this all. But we're in disadvantage because it takes a lot of effort to help people build a conscience, for instance, about environmental issues and the relationships with pandemics. But it takes a tweet by a very famous person, or by a leader, even worse, to destroy that conscience in less than a minute.
Paolo, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sonali. It was a pleasure talking with you.
My guest has been Paolo Giordano. He's an acclaimed Italian author and physicist who wrote the first book about the pandemic called How Contagion Works: Science, Awareness, and Community in Times of Global Crisis, the essay that helped change the COVID-19 debate. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.